What would happen if we had the boldness and the presence to lean into our edges and grow from our core? See, in a world that's shaped by yesterday, constantly chasing into tomorrow, I'm inviting you into a conversation where lifestyle, business, and consciousness share the same office space as your purpose and your brand. This is the Supernova Podcast, and I'm your hostess, Lena Ski.
Ron, welcome to the Supernova Podcast. It is so great to have you here.
Great to be with you, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolute pleasure. I've been hearing such amazing things, and you've been keeping yourself pretty busy in your career, haven't you?
I certainly haven't been bored, that's for sure.
Well, that's always a good thing.
I've had the great privilege of being able to do some extraordinary things with people that I love and care about, and hopefully along the way make a difference.
Mm. Well, that almost brings up an interesting question. How would you define extraordinary?
You know, I think when we get to wake up in the morning, yeah, and use our greatest gifts, and work alongside people that we love and care about and who love and care about us, and feel like the work we're doing is more than just earning us a paycheck, but making the world better for somebody else.
Yeah.
What's not to love? Why wouldn't you want to get up every day and do that? And so I guess most days, not all days, but most days I get to do that.
Oh, beautiful. I mean, what better future of work than designing our careers and our businesses and our leadership and our marketing and how we show up in the world, then with compassion and empathy and living our talents.
And when I discover places that where people don't get to do that, or where they feel unable to do that or uninvited to do that, it makes me sad. It makes me offended. Everybody, I think you know this, Magdalena, given the parts of the world you live in and you've seen it up close. We all have our core no. We all have the thing that just eats at us inside, that we just find that it's an offense to the world. And for me, it's wasted talent. Wasted human glory is just, it just makes my stomach ache.
And it also then led you to doing the work that you are doing, from working with from startups to scale-ups to a huge level of transformation and leadership and teamwork.
Well, and I think that, you know, when we get to help, there are many leaders who do want to create the environments where the people that they guide can thrive.
Yeah.
It's not that, but they don't know how to do it. And so when you can give them the help and the tools and the guidance they need, so that they actually can match what they value with what actually happens around them. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day. Absolutely. So one of the questions that was just coming up as I was reading your bio and having a look at the work that you do is, and I'm so glad you used that word thrive, because it's just such a delicious word. It's like, this is what we need more. Forget sustainability. We need to be thriving. And we can choose to be thriving. I honestly still believe we haven't passed the tipping point on that. Is this question of, you know, with so many startups moving to scale up and everyone just going harder and faster and more relentless in their growth, how do we create these spaces that help us thrive? Because I know that you've been doing work with leaders as well, and noticing there's some disparity. Like, we can throw ourselves into the equation, but then 18 months down the line, we're not quite there yet. So yeah, just really curious about that conversation.
It's a great question, Madalena. You know, what's so unfortunate about the startup world is that they have the luxury of designing in thrivability from the beginning. Right? They could actually, I mean, it's much more complicated to take larger, established, more complex, far-reaching organizations with lots of people and shift them if they're squelching thriving.
Yeah.
But when you're building from the bottom up and mitosis is happening every day as your, not your cells, but your work divides, you could decide from the beginning that you want to build in and design in thrivability from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so when they don't, it's maddening. because every entrepreneur would tell you they did. Of course, I want people to stay here and be passionate, and you know, they came here because they didn't want to be in big companies, and so this is where they get to come. And
yeah,
and they don't and those entrepreneurs don't realize that the mayhem and chaos and lack of organization and lack of cohesion in startups is every bit as thriving, impairing, as the bureaucracies of big companies and the politics of big companies. And so to create thrivability, you have to take a whole systems approach. First, you have to be clear on who you are and who you're not. And you have to make sure everybody's contribution and work and role has a very clear connection to the mission of your organization. And people have to be able to have that line of sight. Mm-hmm. You have to have ways for people to use their voice. They have to, they have to be able to freely dissent. They have to be able to share their opinions. They have to know that the decisions they make matter. They have to have resources and commensurate with what you're asking of them. And they have to be, and their contributions have to be measured fairly. There can't be any organizational injustice between what's measured and what's rewarded. They have to feel like there's meritocracy, that it's fair. Mm-hmm. And if you can create, none of those have to compromise performance or ambitions or very far-reaching aspirations. I think too many people think, well, if I'm going to have all that, I can't have performance. I can't reach big goals. I can't meet my funders' numbers. I can't make my product quotas. And of course, that's foolish and very short-sighted. Mm-hmm. But too many people create this false binary in their minds, and then they create the worst duplicity ever. They vocalize one set of values while their choices and behaviors lead toward a different one. Uh-huh. And that's your kiss of death. The moment people feel like they're in a duplicitous environment where who we say we are is not what we actually do, that's when you begin to see a soul shutdown.
Mm-hmm. And then whether you're a startup or big scale corporate, if you haven't designed that piece, it's so hard to come back for it, regardless of your scale, because the level of integrity that needs to then come in, the level of operations and all in this wholeness, really, that needs to come into that startup, scale up, or organization it's possible, but it takes a whole encompassing new look.
Well, and absolutely. And I love the word wholeness, Madeline, because that's a really great word. You think about the word integrity and its origins of integral. That's what wholeness really is, right? Mm-hmm. In the greatest meaning of the word, it's shalom. And if you've departed from that, if you've led in a way that contradicts that, especially if you've verbalized it, now I see you as a hypocrite. It isn't that you can come back and get yourself aligned and really integrate your values and your actions and lead toward that wholeness again, but it's much harder. And when we get called into organizations where there is a pile of failed changes on the roadside, where they've just gone through, endless churn of failed efforts to change, you form what you call the This Too Shall Pass Club. And a bunch of people sitting on the sidelines, rolling their eyes, going, yeah, I heard this before. Mm-hmm. And now, if you get yourself into trouble as a leader, on the scale-up process or in the need-to-pivot process, and you really need people's hearts and minds in the change, and now you really have to ask for people to get in the game, you've all that equity you could have had, you squandered it. You're so in the red in terms of what you had the right to ask for. And now recovery is almost impossible. And so, the best way to avoid that is just not go there in the first place.
It's also part of the human condition that we do.
So I know. Why is that? Why do we do it? I don't know why we do it.
And yet we don't know anything at all.
Doesn't it just baffle you when you watch it? I'm not young, right? But it's 2018. How many times do we need to see the movie before we go, we know how the movie ends. This is the one I find most baffling, Madalena. Why do we think we'll be different? Mm-hmm. We've watched the movie go this way for everybody else countless times, but somehow we've convinced ourselves, but for me to go differently. Mm-hmm. And then when you wind up in that ditch and you act shocked, like, wow, I didn't see that coming. You really? Because this was the only way it could have gone. It's just baffling to me how much foresight we have not gained from all the insights we have suffered.
Uh-huh. Or we just distort it, you know. We can look at Steve Jobs and go, but he went and did it about in a completely different way, and he was able to innovate, and innovate is the buzzword. But then we're applying the wrong applications or the wrong words to the wrong context, and it just becomes a really interesting conundrum.
Oh, it's such a great point. We hide behind language in such great ways. I mean, you know, alignment. You know, strategic thinking. We have all these, I would love, if I could have a magic wand, I would love to declare a moratorium for 10 years on the words leadership and communication. And force people to find ways to, what they actually mean by when they attempted to use those words. Mm-hmm. Because these terms, so, you know, they've come to mean so many things, they really mean nothing.
Wow. And yet here we are trying to make those changes, trying to dust off all the mistakes that we've made and the ones we're right about to walk right into and wondering why we don't get there. So I'm curious, because you've done some amazing research into this, haven't you? In terms of,
you know, I mean, we have done a number of multi-decade longitudinal studies on looking back at patterns across organizations.
Yeah.
To find out why does failure continue to happen? Why do leaders continue to rise up and flame out? Why do organizations, you know, with the best of intentions, put themselves into strategic ditches?
Yeah.
And it really is fascinating. I think to your point, the human condition of, you know, our own hubris, our own capacity for denial, our brilliant capacity for dissociation, all allow us to create conditions under which we don't thrive. It's really painfully fascinating. But yes, we have in our research and our data seen extraordinary patterns that organizations set themselves up for the failures they then end up looking shocked at. Mm-hmm.
So what have been some of those insights? And also, would you say that it's purely organizational, or can you see the startup market or the scale-up market walking?
I see it at every stage of maturity, mm-hmm. at the inception, at fast growth, at scaling, at mid-cap, and at maturity, mm-hmm. and at, you know, then reinvention and pivot. I see these problems at all phases. So interestingly enough, I mean, it starts when we, in the very beginning, when we start to hire leaders, right? So even at the startup phases, when we're actually looking for talent, mm-hmm. And right in the very beginning, in our conversations where we're trying to draw leaders to us, we set them up to fail. First of all, we're still using the least reliable device to select them, their resume. And we're using the resume in the most proven unreliable device, the interview, right? And what do we say? We say things like, wow, look at these great brands you've built before. That's what we need. Or, oh my gosh, you've built these incredible apps and technologies for scaling. We need those kinds of apps here. Or, wow, you've been able to really grow sales forces and sales processes to scale revenue growth. That's what we need. And every time we say something like that to somebody, we set them up to be a destructive force. Because what we're saying is, you have a formula. You have a recipe that we want. And we want you to come here and apply that formula on us.
Yeah.
So now I think I've got permission. I think I have a mandate to come in and make and change you to what I know. And change you into me. And so we've all seen the movie before, and it's painful to watch. The leader comes in, and they start slapping on their formula, their success track record. They talk about it. You know, well, my last company, what we did was, and they annoy everybody, doing it. Mm-hmm. When the organization resists their formula, they slap harder. Mm-hmm. Until eventually, they get so frustrated, they say things like, oh my gosh, you didn't tell me it was this bad. Or, how have you people ever made money before now? Mm-hmm. And now my diagnosis has become an indictment. Mm-hmm. And the halo that I entered with now becomes a noose. Mm-hmm. And I've put my own slow death in motion.
Yeah.
And I never even had a chance to help contribute to the organization the things I could have contributed. The great leaders, the ones that enter well, have great contextual intelligence. They read the environment, they understand, they adapt, and they recognize that the environment has as much to change in them as they have to change in it. It's a mutual transformational process, and they're willing to undergo both for the sake of making the contribution they came to make. But so many leaders are never told that. They're set up.
What you were saying, sorry to interrupt, about the redundancy or the inaccuracy of the language, because the second option that you're speaking to is what would resonate with true leadership, whereas the first is indoctrination, management, that other style.
Yeah. Oh no, it's complete failed assimilation, right?
Yeah.
It's just it's almost cloning yourself, right? It's telling you, don't draw wisdom from your past successes, just replicate them.
That hurts.
As if it were possible, right? As if it were, I mean, of course it's not possible. Even if you say, well, I've done it three times. Well, actually, no, you haven't. If I went back and actually studied what you did three times before this and three other companies or three other departments or three other places, mm-hmm. If it actually worked, I would see you adapting. I would see you hitting walls or struggling or knowing to adapt or modifying to create the context in which your wisdom and your experience could prevail.
Yeah.
And you, in hindsight, of course, revisionist history is magical. I can just make it all in hindsight go the way I want it to go. But in truth, if I'm going to draw wisdom and insight from my past successes, I'm going to have to apply those and adapt them. They're not going to mindlessly graft on to the current context. And those who are told to do so, or those who are given some false sense of urgency that, oh my gosh, we need this quickly. Can you come do it tomorrow? They just take the bait. They feel like a hero. They're very indulged. They feel very respected. There's this big triumphal entry into their organization that they're announced by. People are waving palm fronds, you know. Okay. And they think, well, this must be what I'm supposed to do. This is what they're asking for. Mm-hmm. I don't want to disappoint them. And I'm new, so I better prove myself. Mm-hmm. And you have all those internal dynamics inside the leader themselves at war with all the external dynamics. And, these dueling narratives of, mm-hmm. you know, he thinks he's here to save us. And he's thinking, or she's thinking, oh my God, I have to save them. Mm-hmm. And nobody's talking about it, right? We're just mindlessly marching forward against each other without stopping and going, wait a minute, what are we trying to do here? Mm-hmm. And unless there's some great intervention early on to help stop the disaster, that's why more than half of those leaders fail in the first 18 months.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And the one word that just kind of coming up as you were saying that is that we just inherently cut ourselves off from that wisdom, and we're not then able to really design for context. We're just going,
oh my God,
old content, the old narrative, that old movie, and doing that sequel or that spin-off that nobody liked in the beginning. And it's why are we surprised that it didn't work?
And isn't that funny? We know it's old content. And we know it's a new and we know it's a new context. And if you ask that person, would you ever advise somebody to take old content and deposit it into a new context and it would be effective? They'd say, well, of course not. That could never work.
And yet
somehow we're somehow blind, or we've convinced ourselves we are adapting it when we're really not.
Yeah.
And the reality is content and context both matter. You need skills for both. And nobody tells you that, right? Contextual intelligence isn't something you are ever given. And so hubris sets in, and now suddenly, you know, you're suffering and don't even know why. And maybe even tragically, your career has now taken a stall, or, you know, you've moved your whole family across a continent to take a new role.
Yeah.
And your children are in new schools, and now suddenly there's a mushroom cloud above your head. And all that carnage is so avoidable, right? It doesn't have to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really want wisdom from your past experiences to just be wisdom and not a formula, the first question you have to ask is not, what about my wisdom applies here? The first question you should ask is, what is it about my wisdom that won't apply?
Hmm. Yes.
And start with, which then says, okay, by default, what I'm admitting is my own limitations. right? If this is, these are the parts of my wisdom that don't fit here, what do I need to go acquire and learn and stretch in to make up for what parts of my wisdom will apply?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the question people are told to ask, is it? Mm-hmm. You know, they're just told, repeat, rinse and repeat.
Mm. And they call it an innovation.
I know!
Really uncomfortable on your skin.
It's called, we're going to bring in fresh thinking. We need some new ideas. We need some fresh blood.
Uh-huh.
And then when the fresh blood gets there, we say, yeah, we don't do it. That's not how we do it around here. Oh my gosh. It's just, it's really painfully ironic sometimes to watch the neuroticism of organizations and how they say they want one thing and then behave in an entirely different way to get it.
Mm. Well, it's no wonder you can't get bored. And we can't get bored in our own human condition and in the thing that we create, even though we're perpetuating these patterns.
Yeah. I think if we were able to, you know, almost make it required practice or reading that as people are begun to be cultivated into leadership roles from the earliest parts of their career and made them learn context, made them learn to read the tea leaves around them, made, you know, almost force curiosity. Uh-huh. You know, like everybody should be required to take anthropology as a study,
yes,
to learn how to, and to be ethnographers as a summer job, to learn to study the environment around you without imposing a bias on it, without imposing yourself on it, and just collect data. And then learn how to build relationships with those people that you're going to lead, learn how to build trust-based connections. And learn that your priority should be, how do you make other people successful? Not how do you get from them what you need, but how do you prioritize your relationships to make yourself known to be a contributor, not a taker?
Yes, please. As you say that, it just reminded me of an old post at the World Economic Forum, I think, put together about the 2020 skill set, which is now adapted to the 2022 skill set. And it was just like, I can see it, but I would just laugh at that because it just pretty much reprioritize the same list. And I'm like, well, where is curiosity? Where is relationship building? Just moving strategic thinking up and down the ladder isn't going to answer that problem.
And most people don't even know what that is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, first of all, it's a redundant phrase. If you're thinking, it's strategic. Most people aren't thinking. But secondly, people confuse, you know, thinking the big thoughts or thinking big ideas or thinking in abstractions or thinking conceptually,
yeah,
with thinking strategically. They're very different things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the strategic thinking has to do with the future. And so by default, if you're thinking about the future, and unless you're thinking about going to it alone, if you haven't got the relationships to get you there, if you haven't got a plan, if you haven't been able to make the hard choices to prioritize what you're going to say yes and no to,
mm-hmm,
and if you haven't read the context around what the future might be, your strategic thinking is nothing more than, you know, self-indulgence.
Sure. Or the worst scale of that, wishful thinking. Just,
well, yeah, it's wishful thinking, delusion.
We're good at that as humans. We're really good at delusion.
We are. We think hope is a strategy. But hope is not a strategy.
And the marketing industry, unfortunately, tells us that it is. That's the way the world works.
Well, and then, I mean, and then you look at all the way short-termism, you know, measuring quarterly results or, mm-hmm, you know, imposing false immediacy on outcomes, just perpetuates the delusion, doesn't it? It just makes people more inclined to believe that they can have the impossible.
So saying all of this, what would you like to see in the future of, let's just throw these words in, leadership, coming into thing? Like, what would you like to see more of rising? Because this old narrative clearly has not been working.
You know, I would love to see, From MBA, even from primary school on, leadership cultivated as a whole new understanding of what it means to influence others, what it means to use power responsibly, and for a greater good, what it means to bring justice as a leader, to see whether, you know, from the playground on, right? Mm-hmm. There's injustices. And how do we use our voices to bring justice? How do we honor contributions fairly? Mm-hmm. How do we make opportunity for other people? How does leadership and kindness become synonymous and not conflicting?
Yeah.
Even when you make hard choices, even when you have to make, I mean, I still think leadership requires disappointing people if you're going to do it well. But sure. But when you disappoint them, do you have to leave them feeling bad about themselves or just disappointed? How do we create a sense of an innate understanding that as human beings, in our human condition, to use your great term, we are hardwired with two conflicting needs, me and we, right? Mm-hmm. I have a deep desire to be individualized and set myself apart, and I have a deep hunger for intimacy and community.
Yeah.
And both are legitimate. And I think too often leaders side with one or the other and compromise the other. Mm-hmm. How do we learn to lead and create environments where you can hold the tensions of both, where we can thrive as individuals and enjoy the collective intimacy of community, mm-hmm. and achieve results at scale we couldn't achieve on our own.
Mm. That beautiful word, interdependence, right?
Yeah, and how do we create a sense that interdependence, sure, interdependence is hard, right? Counterdependence is easy and codependence is easy,
oh.
And they're the counterfeits, but interdependence is really, really hard. But so what? Do it anyway. Because it's so worth it, right? The results you get, the impact you have, to thrive, all comes when you achieve interdependence, mm-hmm. And balance that me and we thing. It's just a lot harder. But I think part of the reason it's hard, Magdalene, is we're not teaching it.
Yeah.
We're not showing people how to do it. We're giving them kitschy, cute little recipes for emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. We're giving them checklists and 360s on how much people like you or how versatile you're seen as.
Sure.
But we're not really teaching the deeper work of what it means to create an environment that allows for true interdependence and vulnerability and honesty that comes and the self-honesty that's required to be interdependent and the safety it takes to allow people to be interdependent.
Yeah.
Sure, it's harder, but so what? Do it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if we have to go to work or clock in at worst to something, why not clock into something that's actually going to help us thrive, help us grow? Help us become better human beings and design that day, because nobody likes to be that little rat on the little spinning cage thing.
That's horrible. And here, I actually think if you actually measure effort and measure what it takes to exert yourself to get the suboptimal results that people are checked out and don't want to be there anyway, and mm-hmm. you're having to sort of push a boulder uphill versus the effort it takes to actually create a thriving environment of mutual benefit outcomes, great financial results, great performance in the marketplace, and great workplaces, I don't think the effort's much different. Mm. I think it's just that our inclinations are so geared toward one version of that. But the reality is that I don't think the leaders who actually get the great results, creating great environments, are exerting any more effort than the other leaders. They're just more skilled and know what to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And if schools could be teaching that, that would be amazing. And especially now also with this AI revolution as well, those are things that the robots will never be able to discern. And it's up to us to really be the gatekeeper.
I just wrote a really, I got to write for the Drucker, the 10th annual Drucker Forum is mm-hmm. next month. I got to write a piece for their LinkedIn series called about our, thriving in our collective ingenuity,
uh-huh.
About the relationship between, in a digital world of artificial intelligence, how do we continue to celebrate the things that only our humanity can bring? And it was a really special piece to write we're making these false trade-offs. But the reality is that what we can do, Peter Drucker is known for saying the computer's a moron, right? Sure. The reality is that, when we see the phenomenal things that AI can do and really the breathtaking things it can do, are we marveling at the AI or are we marveling at the human ingenuity that created it?
Hmm.
And maybe it's both, but the reality is we forget that behind all that intelligence is our humanity. I you know, one of the stories I tell in the piece, I think really illustrates it well. A good friend of mine was with his son at a robotics competition for their school. And their school had gotten to the final two, and they were waiting for the announcement of who was going to win. Mm-hmm. And he looked up at his dad. He said, you know, regardless of who wins, that robot's hands aren't sweaty like mine are, anticipating what they're going to say right now. And when the announcement's made, that robot can't high-five who made it. Mm. And he was saying to his dad, sure, robots are cool, but it's more human. And even at a young age, noticing the differences and the limitations of technology. It just struck me as, you know, whatever our fears or angsts are or our overindulgences are in the technical world, there are things about our humanity that you can never replace. Sure. And until we start celebrating those and start leveraging those well instead of exploiting them or trying to squelch them, there are reasons to fear robots, because robots don't get their feelings hurt when leaders are bad.
Yeah. So hearing you say all of that, I could carry on talking about this. Like, it feels like we've just like tapped on so many different things, and there's so much work to do here, and there's so much to get to work to. It's like, hold on, why is my day finishing? I just want to get back to work and design for thriving right now. I'm going to blame you for that.
I'll take it.
You'll take it. It's the best compliment to get.
It is.
Yeah. What's coming up with that is, like, we're so good at displacing, and we really need to be placing ourselves back in the heart of things and back into what it is that we're actually creating.
Yeah, I think that I hope lots of leaders listen to your podcast. I hope lots of people are, you know, enthralled and I think there are lots of leaders out there, Magdalena, who do want something different. They want different paradigms.
Yeah.
They don't know how to create them. They're not being taught them. They're not being shown the literature where it's introduced. Or there's just so much of it out there that's noise.
Sure.
Sure. That they can't distinguish. But I think if we could tap into that natural hunger for leaders to want to be good leaders, to be respected leaders, to make a difference with the roles they embody, with the power that comes with those roles, and we could find a way to fuel those instincts with the right knowledge and tools and courage, we'd be so much better off.
We would. Ron, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up there. But that has been, I can just imagine heads blowing, supernova effects happening all around with the listenership. And you've really just brought back the humanity in that and that inspiration of what is possible without the shenanigans of, like, let's just motivate everybody to be great. But, like, what does it actually mean to create what it is that you want to create? So thank you so much for that.
No, Magdalena, it's been my pleasure. What a great conversation. I so enjoyed it.
Brilliant. Is there any last wisdom, parting thought, insight that you would like to share?
You know, my mentor, who she's been my mentor for more than 30 years, told me a long time ago, and it was a very formative imprint on my soul. She said, nothing in life is irrevocable except death. Mm-hmm. And her message was, don't be afraid to try. You get do-overs. You know, if you're sitting there worrying about, well, if I say it, what will they think? Or if I try this, what if it doesn't work? Or I really, really want that, but I don't know if I can. Mm-hmm. Don't get yourself tangled up in your own anxiety and fear and self-persecution about what might happen. Just try. Mm-hmm. It might go sideways, but so what? Get up and move on. But you'll have been so much better for having tried and learned than for having sat on the sidelines and wondered. So just try. Get up and get on the field. Be the main character in your own story. Don't be a spectator in your own story.
Yeah. Mm. Such a wisdom. Such a wisdom.
So there you have it. There's no more room at the edge of maybe. In fact, maybes have been taken out and scrapped, or the list all together. Because you're not just in business to create products and services. I mean, that might have been what got you out of bed this morning. That might be what's getting you to pay the bills, but you're here to own so much more. You're here to encapsulate so much more and embody so much more. You're actually in the business of creating openings, shaping connections, and establishing engagement. And this is your exact moment in the space-time continuum to find yours. Because you are moments away from being in the whole new class of emergence and sharing your genius in a very unique, bold way. This has been Lena Ski for the Supernova Podcast. And if you like this, love this, absolutely roared about this, check on over to our Patreon page because there's some extra awesome things happening there for all our patrons. And of course, we could always do with more exponential love to really catapult this future of work into the way that's actually going to make a difference in the world. But, and so much more, if you're ready to become magnetic, evolutionary, and a whole lot more in charge of what it is you're putting out into the world, and intuitively design the products, businesses, service, solutions, and the talents you need to discover and deliver that thing that's unique to you and the DNA of what it is that's being birthed in this moment, you're going to love everything else happening over at www.lenaski.com. See you there.